This podcast is part of the Headstuff Podcast Network.
Hello, my name is Alison Spittle. You're very welcome to the Alison Spittle Show. This week's guest is Dilvik Ramasinghe. She has been on News Talk before, and now she's got her own podcast called Sparking Change with Dil. It's a really good podcast if you're interested in social justice, and you should listen to it. It's on the Headstuff Podcast Network. Thank you very much to Copperberg, who are sponsoring the show, and also myself. I'm going to sponsor the show. I got a gig in Vicar Street, January 13th. Enjoy the show. This is the had Ibrahim Halawa on your last podcast.
Oh my god,
I'm just starstruck being around you.
Such a lovely guy.
Yeah, he is such a lovely guy.
And his sisters are just
legends, because I saw them at the Tatler Awards and it was just lovely. Like, they had a whole table as well,
because I went up to them and asked them for a selfie, and I felt like a schoolgirl.
Yeah,
he was so sweet.
He's such a sweet guy.
Yeah. Poor, the backlash he's got is just horrendous, so.
Yeah, did you see that coming, or? Because you must see a lot more than, because you're a person of colour, than I would. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. I probably wouldn't notice all the microaggressions.
Yeah, microaggressions. No, and I think because he's Muslim as well, he's probably gets way more, you know, because I'm obviously very conscious that racism that I experience, or the homophobia I experience, you know, is subtle. I always think what must life be like for someone like Ibrahim, who's Muslim, or for a 6 foot black Nigerian guy, you know. But with Ibrahim, I felt, just even before he returned to Ireland, there were a lot of people who kept saying, you know, why are we bothering to do anything for this guy, because he's not really Irish. And he is a guy, okay, his name is Ibrahim Halawa, but he was born in the Coom.
Yeah.
So he is Irish. He's got a Dublin accent.
Yeah.
So why are we still living in an island in 2017 where people still would consider people like me, who are here now 17 years, who hold an Irish passport, or people like Ibrahim, who were born here, still as outsiders? It's very annoying.
And I found it weird that they would compare that his case to people that are homeless, or that lady that lady who's walking for her child Ava, and they would say, why are they getting him out when Ava still doesn't have her cannabis medication? And it's not as if we had to choose between both and go, we could get this guy out of Egyptian prison, or we can let this child suffer. And then, you know, it's always like, there's always these weird arguments brought on.
It's about who you consider to be your own.
Yeah,
it's a sense of belonging. It's like the most intrinsic thing about being human is that you want a sense of belonging. You want to be part of the group, you know. So you have someone like Ibrahim, someone like me, who are living here, and we feel Irish, you know. I certainly do, because I lived here longer than anywhere else in the world. And besides, I was born in Italy. I lived there till the age of 12, then I moved to Sri Lanka, you know. So I never had a really strong national identity, because I didn't live enough in one place. So it's really upsetting when you feel this way, and yet some people around you constantly want to make you feel like you're the other.
Yeah,
you know, and like, there's a term called I've heard now for the first time, called paper Irish.
Paper Irish.
Yeah, because we are holding a passport, so the passport is paper. So therefore, it's, you know, you have to be, and it's funny because I have these conversations with people on Twitter all the time. It's like, okay, I wasn't born here, but I have an Irish citizenship. It's like, oh no, you have to be born here to be Irish. I said, well, what about Ibrahim? He was born here. Oh no, his parents have to be born here. I said, for goodness sake, you keep moving the goalposts. You know, when are you going to be happy? You know.
Yeah. I wonder what their definition of Irish is. Like, what, because it can't just be that your parents have to be born here.
Oh, you have to be white. You have to be Catholic. you probably have to be straight as well, you know.
White, Catholic, and straight.
Yeah.
Be so boring.
I know. Imagine if we were like, there's nothing wrong with these people. But imagine if the whole world was white and Irish and, you know, Catholic and, you know, heterosexual. It's just, be, you know.
And I feel that, like, some of these people that give out about Ibrahim, they would, you know, they'll still be very happy about Italian 90 and the Ireland football team doing so well. But Ibrahim's more Irish than three quarters of the people on that football team because he was born here.
But even the guys who very nationalists, you know, who would have been very very upset when the British Queen came to visit Ireland,
yeah,
in his first ever state visit, and the people from, is it Errigi, is it?
Yeah.
And sure, they were there burning flags and all that on Dorset Street, and they were all wearing Liverpool jerseys.
Yeah.
Which is hilarious.
I got a story about that. My dad's English, and he's very, very English. His whole accent is like, oh, he talks like that. And he was working up on Abbey Street. He was rebuilding the front of a shop, and he was doing brickwork. And some of the lads had gone to his building site to steal bricks to throw at people when they were... Do you remember there was a mini fracas that happened in O'Connell Street? It wasn't when the Queen came. It was something else to do with... Oh, it was when the Orange Men threatened to come down.
Oh, yes, that's right.
That love art. Yes. That, and my dad... My dad couldn't stop them or couldn't even say anything to them because of his accent. He was like, take it. He was like, in his most...
In his best Irish accent.
Irish accent possible, yeah.
Rui, take it.
Oh, Rui.
Because he would probably thought the bricks would have been thrown at him.
Yeah. But my dad, like, the weird thing is, like, I used to be very pro-Britain and kind of, I didn't understand why Irish people were so nationalist. But now I'm growing older and, like, even I want a united Ireland now.
It's not quite black and white, is it?
Yeah, it is not quite black and white. The older you get, the more you kind of think about identity. And I feel like I'm lucky because I'm white. So, like, when I moved here, it wasn't... I can do the accent and people presume I'm Irish because I'm white and I have an Irish accent. But I wasn't born here. And
and spittle is not really...
Yeah, that's what gives it away, yeah, as well. That's a big... It's
like Vikramasinghe. It takes a while for that to pass off as Irish.
Yeah. Someone asked me whether that was my stage name before. I was like, I will not pick that kind of stage name. I would pick Fagin or some sort of nice Irish name that I'll never be questioned
or awesome.
On.
You could awesome. Have just picked Awesome. Alison Awesome.
I know. I'm too Irish for that.
Don't be getting above your station now,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly. You know. But we should talk about your podcast, Spark and Change. It's really cool that you're like one of the first... it feels like podcasts are becoming more mainstream now because you're like a big player in the media industry that's now going into podcasting as your sole kind of medium, yeah, at the moment. What was your favorite podcasts back in the day? Like, what kind of podcast did you like?
Now, this is the thing, Alison. Mm. I am so new to the world of podcasting. Okay, I didn't actually listen to podcasts before. This is because I think this is I'm a perfect example of a lot of people out there who consume media in a traditional way. Mm. Like, I think there's a parents' generation would have bought the newspaper. We are now more used to consuming digital media. So, but radio, there was something about, you know, for as long as I remember, when I was 19, I wanted to work in radio. So I never kind of listened to podcasts. I knew my show when I was working in News Talk was podcasted, but I never quite knew that there's a whole generation of people just consuming podcasts. Yeah. So I really came to it. It was a baptism of fire because obviously one week I was working in a national radio station, and pretty much the following week I threw myself into the podcast world because I thought, I realized that this is how people are consuming media. And the beauty about podcasting is like so free. Mm. It's like there's no BAI codes to worry about. There's no issues about balance because like in the manager, in the run-up of the manager referendum, that really bugged the hell out of me because here we were having to talk about the marriage referendum in a balanced way. And at that stage, Alison, I was heavily pregnant.
Yeah.
And I was hoping to marry my wife, my now wife. And it's very hard to be balanced about issues that you know we shouldn't really be having to debate in big to in the first place. They should just pass the law.
Because
you know, love is love and all the rest. So with podcasts, we don't have any of that.
What kind of when you were covering the marriage referendum, sacrifice is the wrong word, but what kind of when you say had to have it balanced, like did you have how did you balance it out from your opinion, or what did you do you remember any bits about that?
Yeah, no, well, I was very, very conscious that I was going to be authentic. I was not going to suddenly change what I said just because it was a marriage referendum. But I did make sure that I allowed space on the show to feature the no side. So I did have the chair of the Iona Institute on not one but two occasions.
David Quinn.
David Quinn wouldn't come on the program. Another gentleman who was officially the chair.
Okay.
And his name now escapes me, but he came on the show twice, and he said to me on both occasions after the interview was over that was the most impartial interview he had ever taken part in, and he was really surprised.
He knew you were gay.
Yeah, he knew, and in fact they didn't even come into the studio. Because I think they felt just I don't think they even want to be near me, you know, lesbian, pregnant, very vocal about the marriage referendum. I don't know. I think there was an element of fear or something. So both the interviews were on the phone, and I just asked them, you know, questions that, you know, just to get their side of the story out. But I did it as a journalist. I was able to do it. But in my editorial, you know, I always talked openly about my experience about wanting to get married and having a baby and all the rest. So I didn't at any time hold my tongue. I just made sure that we shone a light on all arguments.
Okay. And
the BAI never came after me, because in fairness, I think the BAI knew, because there was a couple of workshops that they ran just to help journalists understand, you know, the BAI codes in the run-up to the referendum. And my producer was like, she highlighted the fact that I was pregnant and I was a lesbian and I was presenting this program about social justice and mental health. And they pretty much said, oh, well, let's just say Dil can get away with it because the person, you know, they're hardly ever going to come after me, you know?
Yeah.
So, because it would have just looked terrible.
It would have looked so bad.
Yeah. Look at the BAI coming to harass a poor pregnant woman, a pregnant migrant woman. My God.
Has anyone ever complained to the BAI about your show?
Never.
I've had a BAI complaint.
Did I? Did you?
Yeah.
What did you do? What?
I did a segment on the Des Bishop show on RT2 television last year, and it was talking about these clinics. Well, they put Google adverts up and say, if you are in a crisis pregnancy, come here to get abortion advice. And then their advice is that having an abortion may make you frigid, will make you abuse your child when you're older. Just, you know,
put women off.
Put, yeah.
And actually waste time.
Yeah. Well-researched stuff. And I did a sketch on it. And I remember it was hard doing that sketch because I think they were like afraid of doing it for a while. And then we were allowed to do it, but we had to have lawyers at every turn going over the script. And the Irish Times, it's the Times Ireland edition. They were very good. Ellen Coyne kind of helped me and they got their legal team to look at it. But we still got a complaint. And it was just, you can't talk about abortion without people getting very, very personal about it. And I think that referendum is scaring me. Mm. Like, the marriage referendum was great because, I'll be honest with you, I'm straight, so I was just like, oh yay, this is great for them. And do you know what I mean? It wasn't my life being judged all the time, or it wasn't my you know, and you could go have your cans on the 22nd. Was it the 22nd?
Yeah,
22nd.
Yeah, and 23rd was the day.
What a great day.
What a great day. People were dancing on the street.
How did you celebrate, actually?
Oh, well, that week my son was born. My son was born on... He was meant
to... You could have no cans.
Yeah. I think I had a tiny sip of Prosecco. Because
he's fully developed at that point.
Yeah, but he was meant to arrive on the 1st of June. Mm. I couldn't have planned it better, to be honest. You know, he was meant to be born on the 1st of June, But obviously, I was in a state, and we all were. We were very worried that this wouldn't go through.
Yeah.
And there were people, many friends of mine who were like ready to emigrate. They were like, if this doesn't go through, I'm going to jump on the next plane and get out of here.
Yeah.
But I think I was in such a fragile emotional state that actually Phoenix ended up coming 3 weeks early. So he arrived on the Sunday, the 17th of May. And our first outing as a family was to the polling station to vote.
Oh.
So how emotional was that? And like, and I'll never forget it. We went to the Navan Road. It was like next to the Dominican church,
yeah,
if I'm correct. And as you walked into the polling station, everyone knew, because here we were, you know, sleep deprived with a newborn baby, filling out very emotionally, you know, with tears streaming down our face, filling out a ballot card or whatever it's called. And it was just an incredible day. And then the following day was amazing. I found myself with just the funniest thing.
Yeah.
The first time I actually left my son's side was to go to the George, because Vincent Brown was doing an outside broadcast from the George. And I remember being there and looking around me and going, oh my God, I just gave birth to my son 5-6 days ago. And I'm now surrounded by shirtless gay men in the George. And Vincent Brown is interviewing me. It's like, this is like a dream. It's like
bizarre. Yeah. I know. I just, I have such good memories. I kind of, I felt that I didn't think it would be, I thought it'd be closer than it was, because I'm from the country. And
you're not from Roscommon, are you?
No, no, I'm from Westmeath.
Okay.
My village road, yes, yeah. But only by, I think, about 13 votes or something like that.
It's very close, isn't it?
The village next door to me voted
no. You could actually go and shake the hand of those 13 people saying thank you.
Well, I travelled back to Westmead to vote that day, because I just wanted to vote in my village. Just to
thank you, Alison.
Oh, no. No, it's not. Don't worry. I'm not doing this for praise. I mean, I couldn't.
No,
done
but more. Genuinely, yeah. Imagine there's 13 people that they hadn't travelled home.
I know. And the village next to me voted no, and they lost their post office. Well, I don't say it's a correlation, but
karma.
I like to...
That's karma's come to bitch in the ass.
Yes.
See, us gays are running the postal system.
The postal gay mafia. Yeah. They're just running. I just remember it being such a... I started crying and feeling happy. And then I thought, Jesus, but this is not me or my day. You know what I mean? This is just me crying because I'm happy that my country is somewhat liberal, but for people that are actually being voted on. Incredible. I thought it was kind of disgusting that I had a vote on whether you got married or not,
so,
to be honest with you.
But it's completely
no matter
different.
How lovely and liberal I feel I am, I just don't think I have a right to decide whether you get married or not.
But I think you're onto something, because it's totally different, obviously, the referendum that'll happen, that'll take place in Ireland next year.
Mm.
You know, I don't know whether people will be dancing on the street about it. So
I will.
Yeah.
No
yeah.
matter what the result.
You dance on the street every day of the week, yeah. Alison. So I don't know.
Every day is can day.
Yeah. So but it is a definitely different atmosphere. But I think that's why a lot of people voted no to the marriage referendum to begin with, because they thought if this was to come true and same-sex couples were allowed to get married, then the next thing that was going to happen is they were going to hold a referendum on the abortion issue, and
yeah.
they were right, because this is exactly what's going to happen now. Therefore. And that's going to go true. I know it is.
You feel
big time, absolutely.
Okay,
because I think it's one of those things. Irish people will, because there's more and more talk about it in the Irish public, in the media now, and what will get it across the line, the same with the marriage referendum, is people, unfortunately, people having to come forward and sharing their stories.
Yeah, but I feel sorry for like Tara Flynn, and they are basically cannon fodder for our rights, our reproductive rights. Like, they just become a target then for absolute vitriol and hate, and it's just
it's awful.
It's a lot to put on one person or other people. It's a lot to put on a person anyway. Mm. And that's must have been, I mean, Colin McGorman, he he gets so much horrible stuff tweeted to him about him and his family. Mm-hmm. And he's had that since the referendum where he came out and go, look, I'm sure you get it too, actually. Yeah, yeah. Because,
oh, a big time. Oh, no. All the time. And to the point where I had to call the guards on more than one occasion. Yeah.
And what was, how were the guards with you and what was that situation?
Coming up to the marriage referendum, I called the guards before when I was working in News Talk, because the text messages that were coming in were so racist that they thought someone was actually going to stab me on my way to the car. So for months, my producer would walk me to the car. But coming up to the referendum, it was from a social media point of view, because you mentioned David Quinn. He actually went as far on social media to ask, when we actually said we were expecting our first child, he felt it was his place to ask, who's the father, in a tweet. So that, when he said that...
Tell him it's him.
I know. That'd be hilarious. Thankfully, it's not. That kind of gave permission for every person, not just here in Ireland, but internationally, who would be against same-sex marriage, to just attack me mercilessly. And it was horrendous, because the Colm O'Gorman, I was called a child abuser.
Yeah,
for wanting to have children, and to call the guards, and they were amazing. Every time I've called the guards I've lost count now how many times I've called them. They've been very responsive, professional, and they act on it very quickly.
So. Okay, well, that's good.
Mm. But I often ask myself, are they doing it because I have a profile? Would they be as responsive if? Because I know it's understaffed. It's like tiny. There was one office in Hartcourt Street, and the name of it escapes me, but that's like the office where all kind of racist or homophobic kind of complaints go to, you know. So there's it's understaffed. It's something that needs to be and I wonder if I hadn't had a profile, would they have taken the complaint as seriously?
Have you ever met David Quinn or anyone from the Iona Institute personally, or anyone?
I told you, I invited him on my show loads of times.
And he won't come?
No, they came on my show by phone, but they never actually met me in person, which I think is very interesting, you know, because I know whatever I say to a person on social media, I will be able to say it to them, to their face.
Yeah.
And this is the problem with social media, you know, keyboard warriors. People will say the most horrendous things and insult people. But the reality is, if you actually saw them, they wouldn't be able to say half the stuff that they told you a minute ago on social media, which I think people need to be mindful that just because you're not saying it to a person's face, it still has an impact. So even with me, over the years, yes, my skin is thicker than most, and I'm used to every time I look at Twitter, there'll be some racist or something homophobic or something offensive, but it still doesn't mean that is not going to have an impact on me. I'm just very good at looking after my mental health. I also am very good at distancing myself.
How do you keep on top of it?
Well,
give me some tips, please, Dil.
Well, Alison, it helps that I'm married to a psychotherapist. You know, maybe I consider that.
I'm happy with my one.
Yeah, well, get him to go and retrain as a psychotherapist.
That is a very good idea.
Yeah, a little voucher for Christmas.
Yeah, exactly. That can only be good.
Go do a counseling course. So that's I guess, but that's very important for me to have a partner that I can talk to and who's able to kind of remind me that these are just words on a screen.
Mm-hmm.
And they belong to just one person who might not be in the best mental health themselves. So it's taking it all in perspective. But I know overall my work has value, the fact that I spark conversation. And I'll challenge people even face to face. If I'm in a taxi and someone says something that's racist, I will say, hang on a second. And I will not tip them, you know. so they lose
racists
out.
Racists don't get tips.
So I know I will challenge people, even their family or friends, you know, because people... Sometimes, you know, we all have prejudices. I have prejudices as well. And sometimes I might say something and then I realize, oh, geez, what did I just say? You know?
Yeah.
So I'm able to look after my mental health anyway, because I work in it. I work in mental health outside of my work as a journalist. So it's something I'm very mindful of. But I'm very conscious that there are a lot of people out there who are in the public, like yourself, who might not be might not have the tools to look after their mental health. So please look after yourself, Alison.
Yeah, I should.
Have you had any backlash? Because I have to say, I love your work. You're brilliant. I followed you for years. I mean, since I had an alcohol-free comedy club about 4 or 5 years ago.
Oh, right.
And I know our paths kind of crossed at some stage there because I did a bit of stand-up. So how are you doing with all your newfound kind of success?
I'm doing good. I get my Twitter Twitter block button is great. I do that as soon as when the TV show first came out for the first day, I just kind of muted everyone that didn't like it because I felt if they didn't like the TV show, they're not going to like me, and there's no point in engaging with them or anything like that because, you know, they might dislike me even more after 6 episodes and want to talk to me again, and I'm just not going to talk to them. So I call it my pruning, and I just prune. But like a rose bush. But I kind of knew it was going to be a problem. The week before my TV show came out, RTE shared a clip on their Facebook, and just like I was just not surprised, but I just didn't thicken my skin up. I was kind of busy doing other stuff, and I should have been prepping myself. So that whole, the week leading up to my TV show coming out, I kind of had to go into a boot camp of trying to do meditation and trying to do exercise and keeping off social media and pruning as much as I could. But I was kind of like really disappointed in myself that I didn't expect that was coming. Mm. And it wasn't because I'm full of myself. It's not. It's just I didn't think about that. You know, I was too...
You didn't think people could be mean.
Well, it's just like I was too busy thinking about... I was worried about the TV show itself. And
but you're also a decent human being. You wouldn't say mean things to somebody else. So no, you don't get to go around expecting other people to be mean to you.
Yeah, yeah. And but I'm sure, like... I'm sure I've been mean in the past, I'd say. I nearly want to look back at my Twitter now and see what I was like 4 or 5 years ago. Because I can guarantee you, maybe I said something bad. I just know. Do you know? I just know I'm not perfect.
Yeah, I'm sure nobody is. But
yeah.
But then there's people who are trolls who make it their job to, when you wake up in the morning, and say, oh, how can I make this person's life miserable?
I know. It's getting so much easier, don't I? It's just I've done some pruning and now I'm kind of just... I didn't go watch my TV show with... the first day we were supposed to go to a pub and go to a screening with the producers and the crew and the cast, and I just couldn't go because I just felt watched all the time, and how I feel watched all the time now. Mm. And I'm not
exposed
watched. Yeah, yeah, like if I say, like I get asked about in interviews, like, oh, is there going to be a second series, and I don't know if there's going to be a second series. Mm. So I don't know what the answer is. I don't know what I can say without feeling that I am giving some signals to RTE or to my producers and going, like, I do want there to be a second series, but I don't know how to say that without seeming desperate.
But it's a tough business, Alison. People have no idea. Like the average person on the street has no idea just how difficult it is, A, being in the public eye, but also making a living in this industry. That's why I don't work in it full time. That's why when I first started out with News Talk, I remember...
And what was it like when you first started off News Talk? Oh, well, start with them with the start? Or?
I wanted to work in media when I was 19.
Yeah.
And then I got fired after 6 months in Sri Lanka when I wanted to be open about my sexuality. So when I immigrated, like so many LGBT people, when I arrived in Ireland, I didn't even think about working in media because I was working as a kitchen porter in the City Centre Hotel. And I was thinking, you know, when I switched on RT and I saw someone like Miriam O'Callaghan after I came back from washing pots and pans in a hotel, I thought, this is like two, not just separate worlds, but separate universe, you know.
Yeah.
So in 2006, I had a major mental health breakdown. I was suicidal and I ended up going to a great charity called One in Four because I was a victim of sexual abuse. So when I was sitting in front of a psychotherapist, peeling back the layers of trauma that I have experienced, I remembered. Now, at that stage, I was working in recruitment. I had a really well-paid job as a senior recruitment consultant. So I was making a load of money. I'd bought a house. I was in a relationship, but I was absolutely miserable. Yeah. But it was in that place of self-reflection that I remembered, my goodness, I want to work as a journalist. So I started volunteering in a community radio station in Blanchardstown called Phoenix FM. And it's so funny that I named my son Phoenix. There's no connection between the two. I just love the name Phoenix. Anyway, maybe it was a subliminal, subconscious thing. So for 2 years, I was producing and presenting a program on Phoenix FM while I was working in recruitment, because I felt at least I was doing something that I loved. And then out of the blue, I got a call from Newstalk saying, look, we are holding open auditions for a migrant to present a show about migrant issues. And I went in and I did a demo, and a month later I had my own radio program on a national radio station.
That's amazing.
Which is incredible. So that was 10 years ago, and it was something that I wanted to do, and I'm delighted that I'm doing. But within that first month of working in Newstalk, there was a massive cull and a number of shows got axed, and people were just made redundant, they were just, you know, asked to leave, and people were in the industry will remember. And that happened within the first month of starting with a mainstream radio station like Newstalk. And I remembered, oh my goodness, people can literally lose their job, in seconds here. So I'm going to be smart, and I'm going to work. Don't put my eggs in all in one basket. Mm. So that's when I set up the mental health support practice. So that is my full-time job. And the work I do as a journalist is, I suppose, a part-time job, but it's something I'm very passionate about. But I would never work full-time in it, because unless you are Miriam O'Callaghan or Ryan Tuberty, who's making ridiculous amounts of money,
yeah,
you're really not in a secure job at all.
No, oh my God.
Yeah, so that's why I want people to, and people also make this assumption that just because you work in media, you must get the same salary that Ryan Tuberty makes. And actually, most of us work even below minimum wage.
Yeah,
when you look at all the hours. Exactly. But the average person on the street does not know this. And they feel, on top of all this heartache that you're experiencing, lack of job security, you know, not getting paid properly, then you're having to get dogs abuse as well.
Yeah.
So I'm annoyed. We have to talk about this more and get the average person in Ireland to understand that they need to be kinder to us. Because if it wasn't for people like you and me sticking our necks out and wanting to be in media, people wouldn't have anything to watch, you know, or give out about. So be nice to us.
Yeah. It's just I wasn't prepped for it. And I wish I was a bit cleverer about one. Yeah. Gee, you should have.
Well, listen, you met me, and I have a team of 45 psychotherapists that are just on Mountjoy Square. We're just walking distance practically from your home.
That is very
so
true.
We're there for you, Alison, because I want to make sure that you continue doing what you're doing, because you have, I'm a big fan about diversity. Currently, Irish media is not reflective of our society.
Mm-hmm.
And to have people like yourself and myself in the public eye is really, really important, because you are right now inspiring a whole generation of Alison Spittles, who maybe had no idea that they could be a comedian and have their own show on RT2. You know, oh. So no pressure there, Alison.
No,
but the reality is we need more diversity in our airwaves and on our TV.
And say if you're a person of color listening now. What advice would you have for a person of colour living in Ireland to get into media, or to, like, is there any organisations that they can go to, or because
community radio and TV is always a great place to start, you know? But the great thing now, which is different to what my experience 10 years ago, you don't even have to do that. You can start your own YouTube channel.
Mm.
You can start podcasting. You know, and once you do that, it's all about building your set of skills. And of course, you know, doing some kind of, I hate this idea of work experience, but unfortunately, it does open doors. Because once you have something on your CV that shows that you've actually worked in an organization as a researcher or as a work experience person, that will then, I suppose, build the confidence of future employers, you know. But at least if you're you can actually start broadcasting right now from your own, you know, parents' home, from your own bedroom.
Yeah, or from your own sitting room.
Yeah, as you're doing now, you know, which is something that we couldn't do really 10 years ago.
No.
So I feel, I'm very excited that what we're doing from a podcasting point of view, from a YouTube point of view, you know, there's going to be more people coming into flooding the Irish media now. But my worry is Irish media tends to be so cliquish.
You know? Okay.
Yeah. So someone who doesn't have the confidence, or someone who doesn't have the connections or the ability to actually schmooze,
yeah,
you know, which unfortunately we have to do if you want to get ahead in this business, they might not be able to get in. And I think talent, you know, I think Irish media needs to realize talent comes in all shapes and sizes and forms and colors and sexualities and gender identities, you know. So the sooner people open up and just see talent as talent,
yeah,
and not, you know, what does it look like? What does it speak like? You know, everybody will be enriched by it, because I know so many people who don't watch mainstream TV or listen to mainstream radio because they don't find any of it interesting. Mm. They find it quite bland, you know, except of your show, of course, on RT too.
Dude, you're fine.
What I mean? It could be so much more exciting if they just, you know, treated people. Look, are you talented? Can you do the job? Great.
Yeah.
Or not? Are you so and so? And did you go to school with such and such? And, you know, are you best mates? And you play golf with your man? Oh, great. Come on in. You know?
Yeah. What do you plan to do with the podcast? Like, what's in the... For the new year, what are you going to do?
Well, now we've just released our 8th episode this week with Ibrahim Halawa, and I feel we're just getting into the rhythm of things.
Mm.
Because it's just amazing the amount of people that are so willing to come on my podcast. I feel so grateful that people want to come and talk to me and come and talk to me on Sparking Change. Because I suppose... For a while there, I thought, oh, would people still want to come and talk to me, even though now I'm not on there's not a big brand behind me.
Yeah.
Because that's my old kind of outdated mentality of media. But now I realize, no, it's not about the brand. It's about what we're trying to do here on Sparking Change. And Sparking Change is very much a continuation of my work, the work that I started with Global Village. It's about talking about social justice. It's talking about mental health. By talking to the people who are affected by the issues, mm-hmm. but most importantly, inspiring the listener to actually get involved. So obviously now the biggest debate in Ireland is about the abortion issue. That's, you know, next year we're going to be having a referendum on. I'm going to try and talk to as many people as possible about the issue, so the person who's listening will want to get involved. If they want to create a society where women can feel actually equal and mm-hmm. are able to contribute equally, and never mind the women that face crisis pregnancies, because for me that everyone knows about that issue, but women are not aware that every woman of childbearing age is impacted by the Eighth Amendment. So if you are currently pregnant and you're hoping to access the Irish maternity services, the Eighth Amendment will impact on you in an adverse manner.
Okay.
And that's why I actually ended up having a home birth, and that's why my wife had a home birth, because we felt we wanted to be in control of our birth. We didn't want to be in a situation where we were in a maternity hospital who's telling us, oh, you're high risk and we have to give you a C-section.
Right, okay. Yeah.
So that's what the Eighth Amendment does. It puts the power of how you birth your child, how your birth experience is, in the hands of the consultant. Not in your hands, because it's your body and it's your baby. So in the end, even though I was told I was high risk, I was overweight, I had gestational diabetes, and I should have had a medicalized birth, I went on to have a textbook home birth at home.
How did you do that? Like, how did you prepare? Get a lot of towels?
Or? Yeah, of course. Boiling water. No, I engaged a private midwifery service. And there is, you know, there's... like if I was younger, I would have been able to access the home birth service that the HSC provides. There is a home birth services in...
If you're younger?
Yeah, yeah. There's a certain... See, if they deem you as being high risk, they don't want you to have a baby at home.
Okay.
But the reality is that this high risk, the goalposts are too far out.
Okay.
You know, they want to be... extra careful, because I suppose they're worried that if something was to happen, they would get sued.
Yeah.
You know, so as a result, they kind of, like the most recent research will show that home births are perfectly safe. You know, if you are a woman who's healthy and has a healthy pregnancy, in fact, they say it's safer for you to have a home birth than to have a hospital birth. Because how do you feel when you step into a hospital, Alison?
I feel like my nose gets dry. The air conditioning is weird in the hospital. It smells of gravy and disinfectant.
And emotionally, how do you feel?
Oh, not good. Yeah. Not good, because it's normally something bad. You never go in there for fun, do you?
Exactly. You know? So most human beings, when they walk into a hospital, they get nervous. Mm. And that is, you know, that it releases adrenaline in your system. And that is the enemy of birth.
Right, okay.
Because you need to have the hormone oxytocin. And the oxytocin, the love hormone, is the hormone that allows you to kind of relax into it and labor. And then that, you know. So the moment you put yourself in a hospital, it's bright, people running around, you know, it's consultants coming in with 10 student doctors, and they're all in get in line and give you vaginal examinations. Oh. You know, that's all going to upset the process. You
yeah,
know?
That absolutely.
So, yeah. So as I said, so I went off and I had a home birth, but home birth is not for everybody, but. But if you are hoping to give birth in Ireland, the Eighth Amendment can go against you, because you could want your birth to look a certain way, and because the hospital has the power, they can actually get a court order. Like recently, there was a case of a woman who just wanted to go into labor naturally. She'd had 3 C-sections, uh-huh. and she just wanted to know, what does it feel like to go into labor naturally?
Painful, I'd say.
No, but you just feel the waters break naturally, as opposed to having someone break them for you, you know. And you can understand that, because it's your right as a woman to experience that. But she didn't say she suddenly wanted to have a vaginal birth, but the hospital decided to get a court order to get her to get them to induce her.
Right.
So in the end, they went to the High Court, and the judge said, "Well, I wouldn't take that woman off the street and cut her open. So why would I let you do that to this woman?" So then she went back to the hospital. She went into labor naturally. And then at 6 o'clock in the morning, she was like, right then, I'm ready for my C-section now. That's all she wanted.
Right. Mm. And when you did a water birth, was it? When you had a home birth?
Yeah. And then Anne-Marie gave birth just 15 weeks ago. We had the same midwife in our home.
Yeah.
And she didn't like the water at all. So she decided to do it on dry land.
Dry land.
And it was brilliant as well. So
do you rent the paddling pools? How do you give birth in water?
No, we got it as part of the package. And
package?
Yeah, it's a package. it's a home birth package, and there's different ones depending on how long. Whether you want it from week 24, or whether you want the mini package where it's like for week 32 or something like that. So we knew the midwife who looked after me. We had her again for Anne-Marie's birth.
Yeah.
And we actually used the same birthing pool as well.
Okay.
And it was like a party, Alison. Like we were dancing. I had a playlist on. We had like fairy lights. And there was like,
I just keep imagining Club Tropicana. Yeah. That video. Like George Michael and a Lilo. And you're just giving birth.
That's it. But it was very relaxed, you know. And my son was sleeping in the bedroom. And it was just awesome. And I was thinking, I wish people would realize. And that's why I had my first birth filmed, and it was in a documentary called Truth About Birth that Maya Dunphy did, because I wanted just Irish women to, I'm not saying they all have to give birth at home, but you could see
that option.
You know, birth, when you normally see it on telly, what do you see? You see a woman who's screaming in pain, shouting profanities at the partner.
Yeah.
You know, this is all your fault and all that. Get this thing out of me. And there was none of that. It was really peaceful. It was nurturing, and it was a big celebration when my child came out. There was no screaming and shouting. There was, of course, some groaning because there is a certain amount of pain, but it was just wonderful.
I'm afraid of birth. I'm afraid of the whole, like, because I heard, like, I'm afraid, like, I'd poo myself and that someone would see.
But that's
and
part of birth.
I know, but...
That's part of it. And remember, the people who are going to be there have seen a million women give birth. So poo is actually a good thing, because that means you're about to give birth.
Really?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And it's funny because you know, there's like the fear of birth.
You just have like a Malteser one. Like
it begins, because actually you have a massive clear out before. Because as part of labor, in fact, for me, I remember that moment, because your labor kind of progresses. Like if you leave it alone and you don't take any kind of drugs to bring on labor, if you let your body kind of naturally progress, it kind of kicks up a gear. Kicks up a gear, and it gives you an opportunity to kind of get used to that. And then it kicks up again. And there's a particular section of your labor called, I think it's called transition.
Squeaky bum time.
When it's like you're almost at the end. And that's when I remember, I'll never forget it. I was chucking up and having diarrhea at the same time. Oh, because that was your body clearing out, getting ready. Yeah. Okay, we are on the home stretch now, you know. And it's that's when like, most women say, I don't think I can do this. And that's all midwives get really excited when a woman says, I don't think I can do this, because that's when, okay, now we're in business. Let's get ready to catch this baby.
Amazing. It just sounds like you're cleaning up your house before you have house party.
Yeah. Nothing to be afraid of, Alison.
Okay. Yeah. I feel okay about this. Oh, I'm not pregnant, right? But like,
but you know the amount of women who are actually afraid to get pregnant and have babies.
I'm afraid.
Because of the media has done us a disservice.
Yeah, I blame EastEnders. EastEnders, like, they're always giving birth in cars or burning ambulances or something like that.
It's ridiculous. But I think it has, because there was a time when women gave birth in homes in Ireland, right? And only rich people gave birth in hospitals.
Really?
Yes. And then people who were poor thought, okay, I want everyone to think that I'm rich, so I'm going to go and give birth in a hospital.
Right.
So suddenly there was a status thing around giving birth. And then breastfeeding and formula, there was also a status thing. People thought, oh, you know, only poor people breastfeed their babies. So you had lots of people thinking, oh, formula is better than breastfeeding their children. So there's a lot of things that we have done, the social engineering, that kind of messed with how things should be.
This podcast is part of the Headstuff Podcast Network.
Thank you very much to Copperberg. They sponsored the show. No competition this week, but I thought I'd give them a shout out in the middle, as you were. You must see all of this all of the time, being a mother as well.
Yeah, and I just think it's just such a... It's such a missed opportunity, because birth is like the beginning of your introduction to motherhood. Mm. And if you're able to, because there's huge mental health issues, Alison, when it comes to postnatal depression in Ireland. I mean, our rates are through the charts.
Right.
And that's because in Ireland, we have a very low bar in the maternity hospitals. It's like, okay, is baby healthy?
Yeah.
Is mother healthy? Off you go.
Yeah.
Now, healthy means physically. No one stops to say, did the mother have an empowering, positive, life-affirming birth?
Yeah.
They don't ask that. So a lot of women will go and maybe they'll experience PTSD, like trauma, because the birth was, maybe they didn't have the birth they wanted. Maybe it was really rushed and no one asked her permission before they gave a vaginal examination or broke her waters, you know. So then when she goes home with the baby, she might even end up resenting the baby because of the experience that she's just been through. So that's why I want women to reclaim birth in Ireland.
Well, I actually just thinking about it now, When you gave birth to your child first and your wife gave birth to your child second, what was it like for you to kind of witness your child being born?
Incredible.
Yeah, and did you feel that you had to live up to whatever your wife did when you gave birth? What was her role when you were giving birth?
Well, she was the same. She was... So when I was giving birth, she was just incredible. She was fantastic support, you know, she because that's the other thing about home birth, you really get involved as a partner, because you know you have a certain jobs about the birthing pool, you know, putting plastic down, getting a certain amount of towels, you know, you get a list, so you really you don't feel like a chocolate fire guard like most fathers do, you know, because you actually have a job to do, you know. So Amri embraced that role beautifully, you know. So the baby arrived and she was incredible support. She really helped me establish breastfeeding, you know. She cooked the most amazing meals, made sure that I always had water. And you're breastfeeding, it's so funny because you're trapped under a sleeping baby. And if you're breastfeeding on the left-hand side, you know, if someone serves food to you and they put it on your left, you can't quite reach it, you know.
Yeah.
So little things like that, she was able to, she was so supportive. And the beautiful thing is I'm now able to pay it forward, because when she got pregnant, I was like, this is great, because everything you did for me, I can do now and, you know, do exactly, you know, pay it forward, I suppose, you know. So it's been a wonderful experience, and we're just so happy. I think now I also see just how hard it is in a heterosexual kind of situation, a mother who gives birth to the first child and then gives birth to the second child. It must be so upsetting for the mother to actually feel, okay, now I can't spend as much time with my first child because now I have to give my all of myself to my second child. And I know how upsetting it must be for the first child, you know, for anyone who's who's listening to this, who's a sibling, you know, you're always kind of upset and jealous when there's another child that came after you. Where in this situation, Phoenix didn't feel really like he's lost out, because he had me for the last 2 years, and when Xavier arrived, he, you know, he just gained another sibling, you know. So so Phoenix, when he falls, he'll still run to me. And Xavier, I'm sure when she you know, she still has her primary kind of mother in Anne-Marie, you know. So it's full equality here.
So do you feel then that you have like a slightly different role with your second child then?
No, we're still equal parents.
Yeah.
But the reality is, Anne-Marie is breastfeeding Xavier.
Yeah,
we are tandem breastfeeding
I'm sure people feel like that if they're not breastfeeding their child, that's like
a kind of stronger.
They breastfed the first one,
yeah.
And then for whatever reason they can't breastfeed the second. Yeah. I'm sure that's a different role or something like that.
It's so interesting, because as every day is a, and the parents will say this to you, every day you learn something new.
Yeah.
And I think in our situation, there's just so many positives here.
Yeah.
Because we also work for ourselves. We live above our business as well. Mm. So we are sharing the care of our children. And I feel we are getting the most out of this experience, because we get a chance to work to be with our kids and not kind of putting them into a crash as well, you know. So I just think it's really interesting, and I can see from a heterosexual point of view how much harder must it be when you know the same mother has, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 children and has to kind of divide them herself into five, you know. Where here both kids get, you know, they always have one mom anyway,
yeah,
you know, and now they have a bonus, they have two moms. Like my friend actually said when she was explaining to her kids that Phoenix and Xavier had two moms, you know, and the kid who was like about 4 or 5, her immediate instinct was like, oh my god, you mean to tell me she has not one but two moms? That's awesome. That's a great way of looking for it.
Of course. Do you think, because you've had two children now, is it easier with the second one? What's the pathway like for a same-sex couple to have a child?
Well, we went through the fertility clinic, a great clinic in Clane, and we got a donor from Denmark, because in Ireland, you don't have any Irish donors. Because
really?
Ireland,
there's no banks?
No, because Ireland is so small.
It's run dry.
Yeah, no, it's so small. Chances are your donor could be someone who lives next door to you, you know, and you don't want that, you know?
Yeah, the Irish sperm bank system has collapsed.
Yeah, I don't think that there's such thing, exactly. So, they basically, the clinic we went to, they had an arrangement with Denmark, and Denmark actually has the world's biggest sperm bank.
They have fantastic genes. I've been to Denmark.
They're good looking, are they?
Oh, all right.
Yeah, but you look at my children, they're very good looking. and when they're 18, they have the right, if they want to, get on a plane, go to Denmark and meet their donor.
Okay.
And they have the same donor. So they're half siblings. So, you know, we wanted that. So
that's such a cool thing for that guy to do as well.
Yeah, big time.
Yeah,
I'm just wondering. I see ourselves. I don't know if the kids will want to or not. But if they do, we'll all get on a plane, and of course they'll go off to a cafe to meet this gentleman. And Anne-Marie and myself, I just already can imagine it. We'll be across the street, you know, looking behind a newspaper with dark glasses and French Max, trying to be in disguise to kind of figure out who's this guy, you know?
Because
obviously when he was it'd be 18 years. So what is he, you know, and what kind of relationship will they have? But it's lovely that they can have that.
It's not like it in the films, though, where you get like a list of their attributes or what their job is or anything like that.
You could get a lot of information.
Okay.
You could get a lot of information. For us, we were not really that. For us, what is the most important is their medical history.
Yeah.
What Anne-Marie and I cared for more was like the interests, you know. And it turns out, you know, we're both kind of educators in the different fields that we work in. So the donor is a teacher,
right?
So that did it for us, you know. And we did pick someone who had kind of Anne-Marie's eye color and Anne-Marie's hair color. So, because if we, I wanted the child that I carried to have some resemblance to Amri. Yes, that's the sort of stuff. But the deciding point was the fact that this person worked as a teacher, and I thought, okay, that sounds lovely.
That does. Yeah. That sounds lovely. That's cool. I'm so sorry if this is like overly. Do you feel like because you are in the public eye and you're in a same sex relationship and stuff that I didn't, because I got friends that are gay, and I just wouldn't. I don't know what's appropriate to ask them, because I wouldn't ask.
It kind of depends how you ask. Like, to be honest, that's why we were open, especially with the run up to the marriage referendum, why we were open about having a family and being pregnant, because at the time there were a lot of people who were thinking of voting, who may be on the fence,
yeah,
because they were worried
they
that
the kids,
yeah, what's gonna happen if all these gay people will have kids? It's like, well, first of all, gay people have been having kids from the beginning of time, and just getting married doesn't mean anything. It just means that it's just going to protect these families. So I was very open about how we got pregnant, and you know, the whole process and all that. And I don't mind people asking me at all. It's just how people ask.
Yeah,
you know, because
sometimes like I'm in a supermarket, like, I don't have a right to know either. Do you know what I mean?
No, but the way you asked was just you just trying to learn and you know, raise your own awareness. You know, how did it work? Because there's many ways of doing it. Let's face it, like, you know, we could have used a friend, or, you know, maybe I was in a relationship with a man earlier and got pregnant. You know, so there's different situations. So I'm very happy to talk about that, as long
was
as it's
any of your friends pissed off that you didn't go there.
Did
any friend go, are my jeans not good
enough for you? No, I suppose we didn't have a male friend that we'd known for, you know, but it's really hard to do that, because some people have maybe gone down that route, and then things can get messy along the way, you know.
Yeah, and it's very hard to bring up as well. Like, do you have like a dinner party with just him, and then you're like, By the way,
here's a cup.
Yeah, off loving you your go. Stuff. Yeah,
you know, it would be such a waste to not let your, you know, pass on your wonderful genes. You know, there you go. Please aim. No, we didn't want to do that. We just wanted, we liked the idea of going into a clinic. They did all the legwork for us. They made sure that the donor was, you know, from a medical history point of view, and there was no issues there, you know. So we just wanted.
It just sounds like family was always at the center of what you're, you know, you together and giving birth in your home together. It's quite nice.
Yeah, because Amri and I, from the time we met, it's just 7 years. We've been together 7 years.
7 years.
Yeah, only. So, but from the moment we met, we knew we wanted a family.
Right.
We wanted to have children. There's, and I suppose from my perspective, I've experienced huge rejection from my family, because they threw me out when I was 17, when they found out I was a lesbian. So I've always yearned for a family, and now I have it, and I feel so happy. And irrespective of what's happened in the last couple of months in relation to, you know, the whole hoopla or Newstalk and all that, you know, for me, life is about family. And if I have that, nothing can shake me, because that's the most important thing for me. And if I have that, everything else will fall into place. And I was right, because everything has.
That's amazing. So it's like, you know, in life you make your own family, and you've done that.
I know.
That's incredible.
Yeah. And it takes planning, like, you know, because it's a really hard journey, because, you know, my heart goes out to not just same-sex couples. There's so many heterosexual couples that I find sometimes the whole journey of getting pregnant sometimes can be even harder for them, because like everyone knows, as a same-sex couple, of course you're going to a clinic. Of course you need some support. But there's straight couples out there who feel they can't even talk about the fact that they're having a trouble conceiving and they have to go to a clinic and so forth. So they could be quite isolated. So my heart goes out.
If you're in a same-sex couple, you know, and you've just got married, then the next question is, when are you having a baby? And it will be like that for 4 years until, like, if you're not having a baby, then people go, maybe they're having problems, and they don't ask anymore.
Yeah.
And it's that weird kind of pressure.
Oh, huge pressure. Women, after a certain age in Ireland, they are
and
the constant pressure. And it is a tough journey, because you don't know what's going to happen. I always say, you know, one thing about same-sex couples, we need the support of clinics, and there's lots of heterosexual couples there who are like, okay, I'm sure if it's, you know, it'll happen, we'll just keep trying. And I always say, if you want to have kids, go get tested, because you could be trying for 3-4 years and then suddenly realize, oh crap, I there's actually a problem here.
Yeah.
So you could actually save yourself a lot of grief by when you decide that you want to actually have children, go get tested, make sure that everything is working, and then go at it like rabbits. And at least you know, then there's no issues there. And I don't understand why some heterosexual couples don't even consider going to a clinic. Like, women are quicker to go and get themselves checked out than guys. They're like, oh, I don't know if I want to do that. You know?
Because they don't want to know whether they have fertility problems, because they don't.
Then they're not really men.
Nonsense. It's horrible. It's so horrible. And Janie Mack, well, I talked loads about you giving birth there.
I know it did.
I'm so sorry.
That's okay.
I'll ask you a silly question. Have you ever had dill pickles? And has that been brought up to you before?
Oh, good grief. It was so funny.
I can't help but laugh, because it's 2 months ago when there was the don't mention the war between myself and Newstalk, that there's one particular article. I can't remember which newspaper, but there was a newspaper article that said George Hook in a terrible pickle over with dill. In George Hook in a terrible dill pickle over rape comments. My goodness sake, who's this journalist? Who came up with that? It was funny though. actually, dill pickle is not what I don't usually get that, but I'll tell you what my nickname was when I was in school.
Yeah?
Dildo.
Dildo?
Yeah, dildo.
Oh no.
Yeah. And then I remember one teacher kind of bringing us to stop, don't.
That teacher's an asshole. Yeah. Oh, wait. The teacher was like, don't say that.
Yeah. She tried to, in a tactful manner, trying to tell us not to use the term dildo, because it was obviously, you know. And it's so funny. And then I turned out to be a lesbian. So maybe it was some kind of
it was prophecy. A prophecy.
Yeah, it was a prophecy that came to. Because now I have lots of dildos, different color, battery operated, different sizes. But of course, now we have kids, so they're gathering dust at the moment on the top of the water. Yeah. So if anybody would like a selection of very expensive dildos, come to me, because I won't need them for the next foreseeable future.
It's like a very sad short story. Do you remember, like, children's shoes never worn? And you're like, dildos. Yeah. Those are slightly worn.
They're unemployed, underused. Bless them. I could do a little ad, you know, some violin music in the background.
I don't want to talk about the news talk.
Well, we kind of have.
Do you want to talk about it?
Yeah, absolutely, no problem.
Well, okay. When did you first find out about those comments? And what was your first reaction?
I think it was the 8th of September. It was a Friday, and I was at a charity luncheon with my wife and my children, and somebody came up to me straight away and said, Dill, did you hear the comments made by George Hook? I was like, no, I'm at a charity luncheon. Do you see your radio hanging off my head? Anyway, so that I was in the car on the way home. I thought, okay, I better listen to this, because I've heard so many comments being made, not just by George, but Ivan, and that I've had issue with. Mm-hmm. But this one really crossed the line. I was like, okay, this is horrendous. So I didn't do anything Saturday and Sunday, because I wanted to see what the station would do. And Monday came, and of course there was an apology, and I felt, I remember distinctly listening at 12 o'clock. I put on the radio to see, okay, what's going to happen? I heard the apology and I felt, no, this is not good enough. This is nowhere near enough. And sure enough, the advertisers started pulling out. There was a national uproar, you know, and I felt, okay, I needed to say something. So on the following day, the Tuesday, I emailed my station editor and I said, I don't feel comfortable sharing the same airwaves with George after what he said, because I think an apology is not enough. He should be at the very least suspended. Now, I never wanted him to lose his show. I never wanted him to be fired. I just wanted to be suspended, so he would then maybe go off and maybe
use that time.
Yeah, use the time and maybe go volunteer at a rape crisis center and understand just the impact that those comments would have on abuse victims and rape victims. And so they said, look, we are dealing with the issue. And I said, well, is anything going to happen? We don't know. We can't say anything. So Tuesday went, Wednesday went, Thursday night, I was like, he was still on air. And that's what, like, every day I would switch on the radio at 12 o'clock and hear his voice. And I was like, I can't believe he's still on air. Because in an ordinary workplace, if someone said something that was so inflammatory, the first thing you would do, a manager would come up to you and say, right, you're suspended until we figure out what to do with you. Mm-hmm. And so instead, it was like business as usual. So on Thursday night, I issued a statement. The following morning, he was suspended. And I was like, great, okay. So then the following week, I went back on air. And then I went into the station, had a chat with the management. We had a really robust conversation about the issues. And I felt, you know, in my statement, I said it wasn't just George Hook's comments that I was upset with. I also felt that Newstalk had a culture that enabled these type of comments, this kind of sensationalist kind of comments. And so we talked it out, and I thought, okay, great. I feel hopefully this has been a lesson for all of us. And I thought we had, you know, drawn a line, and we were going to move forward and, you know, together and stronger and all the rest and better informed, all the rest. And then the following week, I was called in back to the office, and I was told that my show was being cancelled. There was no sign of it beforehand. There was no talk of it before, and I said, look, is this anything to do with what happened? And they're like, absolutely not. These changes have been coming down the road for quite a while now, but your show is being cancelled with immediate effect. So just to recap, Alison, the man who made the rape comments still has his job, and the woman who spoke out does not. And so you can make up your mind about what happened.
And they, like, Newstalk got a backlash over that. Mm-hmm. Did they reach out to you after that to try and sort out some stuff? Or
nothing.
Nothing?
Nothing. And the interesting thing is, I haven't, like, in the meeting where the show was cancelled, they said there was absolutely no... Because I said, look, the show's been cancelled. Are you going to offer me another show or another job or anything? You know, is there anything else? Because this is 10 years that I work for the station. You know, and I worked, and I, you know, like, I got a glowing reference from them. So I thought there might be some other possibilities. And they're like, oh, absolutely, there's no issues there. If there's any opportunities in the future for us to collaborate again, absolutely, no. Maybe we could come on as a contributor and whatnot. But that was like nearly 3 months ago, and I have not had a single call from anyone from Newstalk. And interestingly, just last week, 2 weeks ago, I was chairing an event for the National Women's Council. It was the FemFest, Feminist Conference. So I was the main speaker in the morning. I was facilitating the morning session. And Niamh Horan, who is a journalist in the Independent, actually wrote an article.
Yeah.
And she mentioned everyone who was on the panel and included in the day, except me.
And have you...
And it's interesting because the Independent is also owned by the same company that owns Newstalk. It wasn't that I said anything inflammatory about Newstalk. It was just the fact that she mentioned everybody except me. And that makes me... And people know this. People who work in the media know that, and like, Ireland, our freedom of press, you know, we have slipped.
Yeah.
We used to be in the top 10 countries in the world where it comes to, you know, freedom of press. But in the last year, we've slipped down to the 14th place. So that means we're going in the wrong direction when it comes to how free journalists feel to speak their mind. Mm. And that's really worrying for me, because if journalists don't feel free to speak openly about what's on their mind and what are the issues at the moment, then are we really truly living in a democracy?
Yeah.
Because people can only make up their mind if they get accurate information. And right now, since I left Newstalk, I realized that actually there's a lot of journalists in this country who can't report freely because they are being paid by one individual that owns a lot of Irish media, and that's very worrying.
And that person owns a lot of Irish media, like that person
who's Dennis O'Brien, everyone knows. Yeah. Okay, we can say
no BAI. Yeah. But he's not very easygoing either. Like, he takes a lot I've heard good stories about Dennis. I've heard like charitable stories about Dennis. But I've heard a lot of petty stories about Dennis. And
for me, it's really interesting because I've seen both sides to Dennis, because I met the man a couple of times.
Yeah.
He supports a number of the charities that I would come on my program before when I was on News Talk. So I got to see the fact that he supports charities that are actually, as we speak, saving lives.
Yeah.
Right. So that's incredible. Right. And I think it's wonderful. And he does that through the Iris O'Brien Foundation. But at the same time, I've seen the absolute fear that people have who work for him. And I know every year in News Talk, when it was time for the annual board meeting, how nervous people would be, you know. And it's really hard to report on certain issues, because let's face it, Dennis O'Brien is a very powerful individual, and he does own a lot of stuff that often finds itself into Irish media. Mm. Because there's a lot of controversies around this individual. Yeah. So I know, as a journalist working for a company, your salary is being paid by this individual. It's a question of, would you bite the hand that feeds you?
Yeah.
That's the problem, you know. And it's someone from working for the national broadcaster. I'm not saying someone from RT, because I feel Ireland is so small, and you know the relationship between politicians and journalists is very cozy.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm not saying there's huge transparency there either, but from a private sector point of view, you know, if your salary is being paid by an individual who is constantly in the heart of a lot of controversies, do journalists really feel free to report on it, honestly?
Yeah, because I don't think I think a person doesn't have to be perfect, but if it's in the public knowledge, that's okay. Mm. Like, it shouldn't be hidden.
Mm, no, it's not. People can make up their own minds, you know. Yeah. And there are obviously tribunals, and you know, there's solicitors, there's authorities who can follow up on things. But from a journalistic point of view, we should be able to accurately reflect what's happening in our country at the moment. And at the moment, I feel many of us, and I know many other journalists have said this, you know, the Irish Times have said, you know, there's been wall-to-wall coverage on this issue. But I think it's really indicative that the Reporters Without Borders is an international body that basically is the watchdog for press freedom from an international point of view. We've gone from being 9th to 14th.
Mm.
Because they said one of the main reasons for that is because quite a lot of the Irish media is owned by one individual.
Mm.
So it's like the Rupert Murdoch of Ireland.
It feels sometimes working in media feels a bit abusive, that you can't talk about abuse that happens within the industry freely for fear that you're going to be seen as a complainer. And there's nothing worse than being seen as a complainer.
A troublemaker.
Yeah.
I'm a troublemaker.
Yeah.
That's why the door hasn't been, kicked down by offers for me. Because I feel what happened with News Talk has now maybe made other people wonder, could really bring on Dill. And I said, thankfully, I never put all my eggs in one basket here. Because if I was still waiting to get a paid job, I'm still waiting for it, because the podcast is not a paid gig, you know.
Yeah.
So it is very worrying, because again, a lot of people on the street are not aware that the contract, like, for example, I worked for News Talk for 10 years, but the contract that I had was a freelance contract.
Okay.
And a lot of people, if not most people who work in Irish media, are on freelance contracts that don't really, it's not worth the paper that it's written on. And that's why shows can be cancelled with a click of a finger, and not feel, oh, maybe we should pay this person some redundancies, because it's not an employment situation. Okay. You know, you're being kind of brought in on a subcontract basis to do this job, but you're not getting, you know, you're not a PAYE employee, you know. So that's why there's a lot of scope for exploitation. So even the whole idea of work experience, you know, most people who start in the media, they have to start working at the very bottom,
yeah,
making tea and coffee for free.
For years.
Yeah, for years. Yeah. And then you have to kind of schmooze, you know, talk to people and say, oh, I'll do that for you. I'll come in this, over the weekend and do that. Oh, I'll take that home and I'll do the editing bit for you, you know. So that's the only way you kind of get along the industry. But you're kind of banking on people doing favors for you.
Yeah.
It's not transparent. It's not like, and the HR policies, you know, the contracts and, you know, HR practices and employment legislation don't actually apply to a lot of us who work in Irish media or the theatre, for example.
Okay. Because
we know everything that's come out recently through Grace Dias and all the rest and The Gate. So people need to realize that a workplace is a workplace. And if you're paying someone for a job, irrespective of what contract they have, everyone should be given rights as employees. So I really hope that, I know there's a movement now called Waking the Media, which is hopefully going to.
Oh, did you?
Yes, I didn't go to it, but I know of it, and I hope to be at the next meeting. But I think this is just an awakening, because, you know, Irish people deserve to have. They deserve to be able to open a newspaper or listen to the radio or click onto their smartphone and get, you know, news that they can really trust.
Yeah.
And if the people who are writing these articles or you know, reporting on it are not being treated properly, you know, the quality of the media that you're consuming might not be the best quality. You know, because I always start with the whole George Hook thing. You know, we as people who work in the media, we have a duty of care.
Yeah.
For our listeners. So we need to make sure when we report on something, A, it's accurate. Also, we don't need to traumatize people by talking about issues in an insensitive way, you know.
Yeah.
But I think people realize that.
Yeah. It's such an odd situation, because I feel like George was mollycoddled all of his career radio-wise for him to say these things, or feel that it was acceptable to say these things. And I think he's surprised at the reaction that... I think a lot of people are surprised at the reaction that he got. But it's a great reaction, and it's a fair reaction. And it's just because... people were allowed to say whatever they liked for ages, and he was allowed to get away with it. And you stood up, and the weird thing about you, Sock, is there's loads of all the women are being fired, and no one's saying anything about it. No one's.
But we already had very few women to begin with.
I know, but now they're gone. Yeah, gone. Yeah. There's one lady.
Yeah.
Ciara Kelly.
Yeah, Ciara Kelly's there, exactly.
That's the only one.
Yeah, I think so.
Trying to think.
No, I think Orla Barry. I think Orla Barry's still there on Saturday.
Oh, right.
And I'm not sure who else, but it's not good enough, because A, it wasn't diverse to begin with.
Yeah.
But this is the type of media. It's like for me.
But you didn't want him fired.
No,
you
didn't want him fired.
Suspended.
No. But it's sensational media. It's like people are being. It's like, you know, there's this idea: bad stories sell newspapers.
Yeah.
And I think in a way, what Newstalk was doing with certain characters like George Hook, he's not the only one. There's Ivan Yates would be another broadcaster that I would have huge issues with what he says. But I feel they say things just to get a reaction out of the public.
Yeah,
you know, like oftentimes there'll be things that are said that are bordering on actually, you know, being xenophobic or racist or even, you know, homophobic. You know, and it's like they're kind of picking on an easy target. Like when there was during the recession, everybody scapegoated the migrants. Because, sure, we're in a recession because of them. It's easy enough to blame the migrants, because the migrants can't speak for themselves, you know.
Yeah.
There's very few of them in politics or in media, you know. So I feel it's like, you know, if instead of just worrying about, you know, getting, you know, producing sensational media, why can't you just provide accurate information?
Yeah.
And but also apart from all that, because for me, working from a mental health point of view, this is, you know, I want to live in a compassionate country where we are mindful of what comes out of our mouths. Going back to how the conversation about the response you got, the negative response you got with your show.
Yeah. Why I was like 99% positive.
Yeah.
Just one.
Yeah. Know, but I feel, why can't we be more compassionate towards each other? Because from a mental health point of view, if someone is having a bad day, right? Yeah. I'm just going back to George Hook's comments. If someone's having a bad day, or maybe they have experienced trauma and were raped in the past, and then they heard that comment made by George, that could have been the straw that broke the camel's back. Mm-hmm. And that could have set that person in, you know, it could have set off a sequence of events. Who knows what could have been at the end of that, you know? So I think people who work in the media need to realize we have huge responsibility. Of course, we need to be able to speak our mind, but we can do it in a way that is compassionate and, you know, in a way that we know that we have a responsibility to the duty of care of our listeners. So that's all I wanted. I never wanted George Hook to be fired. And I think there should be, you know, room for all of us. Let's be respectful.
I feel that you were painted in a way in the media that you were like the head of the people that wanted George Hook fired. But it's just because you made a statement and you put your head above the parapet. It's like when Tara Flynn puts her head above the parapet and, you know, talks about a personal story to her, then people point all this vitriol at this person. Like, do you, and like, I'm only saying it from my point of view, but do you feel that you were given a fair chance in the reporting of this situation?
No, I think there was a very fair, I felt anyway, the coverage, I thought, was very fair, because I think people saw really what happened. Even though the reason I was given that the show was cancelled due to scheduling changes, I think everyone kind of saw through that. And I was happy with that, because I was...
You think they could have waited a few months?
And this is the thing. This is the thing. All they had to wait is maybe 6 months. And then they could have just said, look, you know, the show has run its course. Goodbye. But that's the thing that even scares me even more.
Yeah.
That there was actually no...
No concern for
what of how this is going to look. What are the optics of this going to look? And my heart goes out to a lot of the colleagues that I left behind in News Talk who I really enjoyed working over the years, and I know staff morale was quite low anyway with what had happened with advertisers being pulling out and all the rest, and then what happened to me. I know a lot of people were really found it really hard to go into work, you know. So yeah, that's again it's like creating a more compassionate world, you know. So I think I worry about what's the message this is sending to the next generation of aspiring journalists. Yes, go ahead and do speak your mind, but not too much, because to see what happened to Dill.
I think that's exactly what's going to happen.
Yeah. So that's
the saddest bit of it.
Yeah. So again, you know, if you for a country to be a real democracy, the media has to be free, and at the moment it's not. Because people are not going to be able to make up, you know, people are going to be not able to make up their own mind about the politicians and the government. Are they doing the right thing or not? You know, are they really making enough of an effort to address the homeless crisis in Ireland? You know, the only way people listen nowadays is if they're named and shamed, if the journalists are able to do their job.
Yeah.
You know, so journalists have huge power to actually really spark change.
Yeah.
And that's why I became a journalist. I wanted to talk about the issues by talking to the people who are affected by the issues, not just to a bunch of talking heads or academics. So of course, they're important. But the reality is, you know, getting it from the horse's mouth is the best, you know, because people then can empathize. No, but then but back to my podcast, Sparking Change.
Absolutely.
There is an awakening at the moment. The Me Too campaign is global. It has caught on here in Ireland. Obviously, you have the Waking Feminists, and now you have the Waking Media. And I know there's so many people who keep coming up to me saying, thank you so much for what you did, because that has made people really aware about the state of the media of this country. So knowledge is power, Alison. It might seem like this is a negative way to end, but I actually think it's a positive thing, because we realize just how big the problem is in Ireland.
Yeah.
So we need to obviously change do something about the freedom of press in Ireland. We need to do something about creating a more compassionate, respectful workplace, irrespective of what that workplace is, whether it's in a TV station or a radio station or a theater. But there is an awakening, and that's what the podcast is all about. It's about individuals raising their own awareness, you know, by listening to a program like Spark and Change, but then going a step further and actually thinking, okay, I need to be part of this and do something to spark change in my own world, whether it's in my own workplace or whether it's in my own family, over at the Sunday dinner, somebody makes a comment that that needs to be addressed, you know. So people can make a difference irrespective of how small it might seem to them, but together we can create a tsunami of change.
I feel positive now.
There you go, Alison. I would never leave our conversation on a low point, but because I genuinely feel there is a lot of hope.
Do you know why? Because I didn't want to bring it up with you. We talked now for a long time.
Yeah, and I was kind of, I've grown roots here. Yeah, my poor family is going to send out search parties. Where is she gone? My wife is going to think, is she having an affair with Alison Spittle? What's going on?
That's how long it takes, baby.
Poor partner is going to be wondering as well, what's going on?
I know. But thank you so much for coming. You can listen to Dill's podcast, Spark and Change, on the Head Stuff Podcast Network. And I fully recommend you do, because it's very good. She gets better guests than I do. I'm so jealous of some of your guests. Wait, I'm very happy with my guests.
Yes, yeah.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, I know. That's hilarious.
I know.
You're mad thing, yeah.
Edit that out.
I gave you so much of my time. Then you insult me at the end.
You as a guest. I'm happy.
Keep digging, Alison.
Every week, I'm just like, oh, I would have loved to have that person. And now I can't ask them for a few ups because she'll think I'm stealing her guests.
Good guess. Can I say congratulations on your recent success?
Oh, thank you. And congratulations on your recent success and your beautiful family as well. That's so great. Genuinely. And thank you so much for answering my nosy questions about babies.
I know. Again, your partner will be wondering, why is she asking so many questions? Has she got something to tell me?
I'm going to go to Clay.
I don't need you.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you very much for listening. Let's do the credits. Andrea Farrell, Sarah Garvey, fantastic producers. William Conway, who did the great art, and Bobby Ahern from No Monster Club did the music. He did a theme tune. You know, he's available for any of your musical needs as well. If you're doing a film and you need someone to score it, why don't you follow Bobby Ahern on Twitter? I think his name is Bobby. He's very good on Instagram as well. But employ the man. Employ everyone, actually, that works for me. They're all very good in their chosen fields. And gotta hustle. Gotta get more work for people. You know, the recovery is happening, I've been told. Thank you so much for listening. Merry Christmas as well, because it's the Christmas episode. Woohoo, festive. Thanks so much for listening, especially the guy that stopped me on the train to Mullingar. He was listening to the David O'Doherty episode on his iPad and flipped it round and showed me. It was so cool. But thank you for real for listening over the past, nearly 2 years now. Ye have been the sunshine of my life, and I really love making podcasts for you. Especially people that come out to the live shows as well. You're great crack, and thank you so much. I'll chat to you in the new year, I think. Yeah, it's going to be the new year. It's going to be very near to the new year, with episodes from Tony Cantwell and Neil Delamere. Just did the live show tonight with them. I had great crack, and I think they're going to be really funny episodes. And thanks very much to Copperberg, who gave away free cider at the gig. I can't thank them enough. They've been really good. But I'm just going to quickly mention to you my tour that's happening this year. I've been very organised, and I have a list here. So in the new year, you can catch me at the Spirit Store in Dundalk on the 5th of January. On the 13th of January, it's the Big Kahuna. It's Vicar Street with Sophie Hagen, who's my best friend in comedy, and I love her. And Rufa Kelly Hunter, who's a very good friend in comedy, and I love her. And go catch it. It'll be great fun. You can get tickets at Ticketmaster. The 20th of January, I'm in the Glen Centre in Manor Hamilton. 24th of January, I'm at the Out to Lunch Festival in Belfast. That's a lunchtime gig. Go check it out. 25th of January, I'm in Clonakilty. That is very far away from Belfast. That may have been a silly decision on my behalf, but you know what? I hear that the bars in Clonakilty is a great gig, and I'm really looking forward to doing it. The 2nd of February, I'm in the Quarter Block Party in Cork. Also on the 9th of February, I'm at the Set Theatre in Kilkenny. I'm really looking forward to that one. I love playing Kilkenny at the festival, and I'm just going to have a great time. The 10th of February, the Town Hall in Galway. Tickets are selling really well for that. I've got 20 tickets left for the Town Hall in Galway. So if you're thinking of coming to see me or buying it as a Christmas present for someone, go buy it soon enough. I think it'll sell out. I got a good feeling. I think 20 to sell in about 2 months. I can do that. Then the 2nd of March, the Visual in Carlow, and the 9th of March at the Source Art Centre in Thurles. I'm going to be adding more gigs later on this year. So please check out alisonspittle.com or my Facebook page, Alison Spittle Comedy, for more information. I think this has been professional intro, outro, and advert. I am so tired. I did a perfect one. You should have heard it, mate. It was perfect. But my SD card filled up. And this will do. All right. I've done my best. I hope you have a wonderful Christmas. Bye. This is the
This has been a production of the Head Stuff Podcast Network.